Chapter 20 Heartbeat. Back in 2009 in Japan, when I went to that fateful China conference as a substitute briefer, I guess I'd made some friends, especially at the Joint Counterintelligence Training Academy, JCITA, and its parent agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA. In the 3 years since, JCITA had invited me a half dozen or so times to give seminars and lectures at DIA facilities. Essentially, I was teaching classes in how the American intelligence community could protect itself from Chinese hackers and exploit the information gained from analyzing their hacks to hack them in return. I always enjoyed teaching, certainly more than I ever enjoyed being a student, and in the early days of my disillusionment toward the end of Japan and through my time at Dell, I had the sense that were I to stay in intelligence work for the rest of my career, the positions in which my principles would be least compromised and my mind most challenged would almost certainly be academic. Teaching with the JCITA was a way of keeping that door open. It was also a way of keeping up to date. When you're teaching, you can't let your students get ahead of you, especially in technology. This put me in the regular habit of perusing what the NSA called read boards. These are digital bulletin boards that function something like news blogs, only the news here is the product of classified intelligence activities. Each major NSA site maintains its own, which its local staff updates daily with what they regard as the day's most important and interesting documents, everything an employee has to read to keep current. As a holdover from my JCITA lecture preparation, and also frankly because I was bored in Hawaii, I got into the habit of checking a number of these boards every day. My own site's read board in Hawaii, the read board of my former posting in Tokyo, and various read boards from Fort Meade. This new low-pressure position gave me as much time to read as I wanted. The scope of my curiosity might have raised a few questions at a prior stage of my career, but now I was the only employee of the Office of Information Sharing. I was the Office of Information Sharing, so my very job was to know what shareable information was out there. Meanwhile, most of my colleagues at the tunnel spent their breaks streaming Fox News. In the hopes of organizing all the documents I wanted to read from these various read boards, I put together a personal best-of-the-read board queue. The files quickly began to pile up until the nice lady who managed the digital storage quotas complained to me about the folder size. I realized that my personal read board had become less a daily digest than an archive of sensitive information with relevance far beyond the day's immediacy. Not wanting to erase it or stop adding to it, which would have been a waste, I decided instead to share it with others. This was the best justification for what I was doing that I could think of, especially because it allowed me to more or less legitimately collect material from a wider range of sources. So, with my boss's approval, I set about creating an automated read board, one that didn't rely on anybody posting things to it, but edited itself. Like Epic Shelter, my automated read board platform was designed to perpetually scan for new and unique documents. It did so in a far more comprehensive manner, however, peering beyond NSANet, the NSA's network, into the networks of the CIA and the FBI, as well as into the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communications System, JWICS, the Department of Defense's top-secret intranet. The idea was that its findings would be made available to every NSA officer by comparing their digital identity badges, called PKI certificates, to the classification of the documents, generating a personal read board customized to their clearances, interests, and office affiliations. Essentially, it would be a read board of read boards, an individually tailored newsfeed aggregator, bringing each officer all the newest information pertinent to their work, all the documents they had to read to stay current. It would be run from a server that I alone managed, located just down the hall from me. That server would also store a copy of every document it sourced, making it easy for me to perform the kind of deep interagency searches that the heads of most agencies could only dream of. I called this system Heartbeat because it took the pulse of the NSA and of the wider IC. The volume of information that crashed through its veins was simply enormous as it pulled documents from internal sites dedicated to every specialty, from updates on the latest cryptographic research projects to minutes of the meetings of the National Security Council. I'd carefully configured it to ingest materials at a slow, constant pace, so as not to monopolize the undersea fiber optic cable tying Hawaii to Fort Meade. But it still pulled so many more documents than any human ever could that it immediately became the NSA-NET's most comprehensive read board. Early on in its operation, I got an email that almost stopped Heartbeat forever. A faraway administrator, apparently the only one in the entire IC who actually bothered to look at his access logs, wanted to know why a system in Hawaii was copying one by one every record in his database. He had immediately blocked me as a precaution, which effectively locked me out, and was demanding an explanation. I told him what I was doing and showed him how to use the internal website that would let him read Heartbeat for himself. His response reminded me of an unusual characteristic of the technologist's side of the security state. Once I gave him access, his wariness instantly turned into curiosity. He might have doubted a person, but he'd never doubt a machine. He could see now that Heartbeat was just doing what it had been meant to do, and was doing it perfectly. He was fascinated. He unblocked me from his repository of records and even offered to help me by circulating information about Heartbeat to his colleagues. Nearly all of the documents that I later disclosed to journalists came to me through Heartbeat. It showed me not just the aims, but the abilities of the IC's mass surveillance system. This is something I want to emphasize. In mid-2012, I was just trying to get a handle on how mass surveillance actually worked. Almost every journalist who later reported on the disclosures was primarily concerned with the targets of surveillance, the efforts to spy on American citizens, for instance, or the leaders of America's allies. That is to say, they were more interested in the topics of the surveillance reports than in the system that produced them. I respect that interest, of course, having shared it myself, but my own primary curiosity was still technical in nature. It's all well and good to read a document or to click through the slides of a PowerPoint presentation to find out what a program is intended to do. But the better you can understand a program's mechanics, the better you can understand its potential for abuse. This meant that I wasn't much interested in the briefing materials, like, for example, what has become perhaps the best-known file I disclosed, a slide deck from a 2011 PowerPoint presentation that delineated the NSA's new surveillance posture as a matter of six protocols: sniff it all, know it all, collect it all, process it all, exploit it all, partner it all. This was just PR speak, marketing jargon. It was intended to impress America's allies, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the UK, the primary countries with which the United States shares intelligence. Together with the United States, these countries are known as the Five Eyes. Sniff it all meant finding a data source. Know it all meant finding out what that data was. Collect it all meant capturing that data. Process it all meant analyzing that data for usable intelligence. Exploit it all meant using that intelligence to further the agency's aims. And partner it all meant sharing the new data source with allies. While this six-pronged taxonomy was easy to remember, easy to sell, and an accurate measure of the scale of the agency's ambition and the degree of its collusion with foreign governments, it gave me no insight into how exactly that ambition was realized in technological terms. Much more revealing was an order I found from the FISA court, a legal demand for a private company to turn over its customers' private information to the federal government. Orders such as these were notionally issued on the authority of public legislation. However, their contents, even their existence, were classified top secret. According to Section 215 of the Patriot Act, aka the Business Records provision, the government was authorized to obtain orders from the FISA court that compelled third parties to produce any tangible thing that was relevant to foreign intelligence or terrorism investigations. But as the court order I found made clear, the NSA had secretly interpreted this authorization as a license to collect all of the business records, or metadata, of telephone communications coming through American telecoms, such as Verizon and AT&T, on an ongoing daily basis. This included, of course, records of telephone communications between American citizens, the practice of which was unconstitutional. Additionally, Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act allows the IC to target any foreigner outside the United States deemed likely to communicate foreign intelligence information, a broad category of potential targets that includes journalists, corporate employees, academics, aid workers, and countless others innocent of any wrongdoing whatsoever. This legislation was being used by the NSA to justify its two most prominent internet surveillance methods, the PRISM program and upstream collection. PRISM enabled the NSA to routinely collect data from Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, PalTalk, YouTube, Skype, AOL, and Apple, including email, photos, video and audio chats, web browsing content, search engine queries, and all other data stored on their clouds, transforming the companies into witting co-conspirators. Upstream collection, meanwhile, was arguably even more invasive. It enabled the routine capturing of data directly from private sector internet infrastructure, the switches and routers that shunt internet traffic worldwide via the satellites in orbit and the high-capacity fiber optic cables that run under the ocean. This collection was managed by the NSA's Special Sources Operations Unit, which built secret wiretapping equipment and embedded it inside the corporate facilities of obliging internet service providers around the world. Together, PRISM, collection from the servers of service providers, and upstream collection, direct collection from internet infrastructure, ensured that the world's information, both stored and in transit, was surveillable. The next stage of my investigation was to figure out how this collection was actually accomplished. That is to say, to examine the documents that explained which tools supported this program and how they selected from among the vast mass of dragnetted communications those that were thought worthy of closer inspection. The difficulty was that this information did not exist in any presentation, no matter the level of classification, but only in engineering diagrams and raw schematics. These were the most important materials for me to find. Unlike the Five Eyes pitch deck cant, they would be concrete proof that the capacities I was reading about weren't merely the fantasies of an over-caffeinated project manager. As a systems guy who was always being prodded to build faster and deliver more, I was all too aware that the agencies would sometimes announce technologies before they even existed, sometimes because a cliff-type salesperson had made one too many promises, and sometimes just out of unalloyed ambition. In this case, the technologies behind upstream collection did exist. As I came to realize, these tools are the most invasive elements of the NSA's mass surveillance system, if only because they're the closest to the user, that is, the closest to the person being surveilled. Imagine yourself sitting at a computer, about to visit a website. You open a web browser, type in a URL, and hit enter. The URL is, in effect, a request, and this request goes out in search of its destination server. Somewhere in the midst of its travels, however, before your request gets to that server, it will have to pass through turbulence, one of the NSA's most powerful weapons. Specifically, your request passes through a few black servers stacked on top of one another, together about the size of a four-shelf bookcase. These are installed in special rooms at major private telecommunications buildings throughout allied countries, as well as in U.S. embassies and on U.S. military bases, and contain two critical tools. The first, Turmoil, handles passive collection, making a copy of the data coming through. The second, Turbine, is in charge of active collection, that is, actively tampering with the users. You can think of turmoil as a guard positioned at an invisible firewall through which internet traffic must pass. Seeing your request, it checks its metadata for selectors or criteria that mark it as deserving of more scrutiny. Those selectors can be whatever the NSA chooses, whatever the NSA finds suspicious, a particular email address, credit card, or phone number, the geographic origin or destination of your internet activity, or just certain keywords such as anonymous internet proxy or protest. If turmoil flags your traffic as suspicious, it tips it over to Turbine, which diverts your request to the NSA's servers. There, algorithms decide which of the agency's exploits, malware programs, to use against you. This choice is based on the type of website you're trying to visit as much as on your computer's software and internet connection. These chosen exploits are sent back to Turbine by programs of the Quantum Suite, if you're wondering, which injects them into the traffic channel and delivers them to you, along with whatever website you requested. The end result? You get all the content you want, along with all the surveillance you don't. And it all happens in less than 686 milliseconds, completely unbeknownst to you. Once the exploits are on your computer, the NSA can access not just your metadata, but your data as well. Your entire digital life now belongs to them.